Welcome to another episode of Lamb Talk. I'm your host, Mike McDonald, sitting here with Timmy One Take.
What's up?
Today, we're very, very lucky to have Chris Erst coming in. Gaffer extraordinaire.
Hola.
How you doing, Chris?
Hey, Chris.
I'm fired up. I'm ready to go.
Thanks for joining us today.
Yeah.
Nice guitar
for having me.
Action there. That was him on the guitar right there.
I saw Tim backing me up on the air guitar there. It was pretty impressive, you know? We should get a live band one of these days.
That's a good idea.
Do the whole full open and karaoke.
Dude, we
and,
get Shane Salyards in here.
Yeah, let's rock and roll.
We have gaffers and juicers are musicians. Have you noticed that?
Yeah, we failed at all the first things we did in life, so we just kind of moved on to being lighting guys, you know?
So when did you get into, when did you start?
I knew I wanted to make movies and, like, work on TV commercials, anything, when I was 10. Even that early, I knew, like, that's what I wanted to do. And it just kind of was luck that I got into juicing in college. I was working on a low-budget, you know, movie, and I was doing graphics for it. And someone was getting ready to plug in a Camlock, and the lines were hot. And I knew. I said, "Stop, man! You can't do that." Like, you know, I could jump. And they were like, "No." Nobody had a clue. Nobody knew what I was talking about. And so the professor of the class, and it was his film that we were doing off campus, you know. And he was like, "That's it. He's the gaffer." And I was like, and they had like a real DP. Like, he had come down from LA and he knew, you know, I mean, I don't remember his name, but he'd worked on some TV shows. And so I was like, well, I'm going to embarrass everybody. Like, I don't know what I'm doing. And he's like, no. You just do what he says. Just do what he says. And man, we had like this old 5-ton film set van or truck. And yeah, I mean, I used every light on there.
What city? Was that in LA?
San Diego.
Oh, it was San Diego.
Yeah, I went to San Diego State.
Oh, cool.
And, you know, we worked, you know, 18-hour days, like 6-hour turnarounds. And, you know, it's just ridiculous. Like, I just kind of got lucky that they made me the gaffer for that little thing. And then every student after that was like, well, he gaffed that like teacher's film. So you got to have Chris. And so then that was it. Like, I gaffed, like, you know, 60-70% of the projects at San Diego State for, like, you know, the three and a half years.
No kidding.
3 years I was there.
So. What a trip. So you're at San Diego. It's got a reputation for quite the party school, by the way.
Yeah.
So yeah, you're gaffing over there. You're doing a lot of student projects. And then how did you get into the union in L.A.? Picked up some kids with some of your friends. Name a couple of those guys that you came up through the ranks with.
Oh, man. I rode a lot of people's coattails in the early days. You know, when I first got out of college, I was working a lot with this guy, Ron Nager, who's still one of my favorites. I haven't talked to him in years, but he was always brilliant, knew exactly what he wanted to do. I think he won 3 student Emmys at San Diego State. I mean, he was the first to do it. I don't know if anybody's ever done it since. But, you know, I used to work a lot with him and a couple of his DPs. I got really lucky that I jumped from San Diego State with another guy, Greg Flores, who started Grip Rigs out of San Diego. But he got me on as a grip on some of the early shows down at Stu Siegel in San Diego. So I actually joined 495 first. So I was working down there, Veronica Mars, Point Pleasant, and then I got really lucky that another show came down, I think it was on UPN, but I was like 26 years old, union show, and they didn't have a gaffer. It was a low budget. And the idea was that it was going to be like each episode was under 250,000. So, you know, it was like 250 for the gaffer. And, you know, all these old timers didn't want to touch it. And so DP was looking for some people and they interviewed me. It's like, I like the kid. So I did the pilot and, it was Fashion House, I think. It was like Bo Derek and got picked up, ran with the show, and the DP said, I'm sticking with the kid. So that was it. And then I made a lot of friends through that, and then eventually just made my way to L.A. because of an ex-wife. So she said, you don't come up here. You don't have a girlfriend anymore. And I said, all right, I'm on my way. And so I came up here, and then 728 took a few years just making new – you're starting over in a new city. So that took a few years to just kind of make friends, but, you know, was on a TV show that flipped. I think it was a game show. That flipped, got my days, and, you know, I haven't looked back since.
Awesome.
Yeah.
And then, so how did you meet Bobby Weatherspoon?
Oh, Bobby Weatherspoon. That was through Josh Day.
Oh, so, Josh Day.
Yeah, Josh Day, one of the best, like, best boys there is. The guy's a machine. He never stops. We did a job together up at one of the ranches outside of town, and it was the worst job I've ever been on in my life. was 22 or 23 hours of just 2-aught, 4-aught.
Wow.
Just boa movers on top of every roof, decos on every, I mean, it was, we had, I think the crew was like 34 electricians.
Wow.
We had 3 10-ton trucks full of gear, and it was just massive. And for whatever reason, they weren't allowed pre-rig, weren't allowed anything, just as much crew as you can find. And you have to be in and off the lot by this time. And cool. Man, it was brutal. But after that, you know, you get through something like that with somebody and then you become good friends. And so, yeah, so Bobby Witherspoon was with Josh from that job. So, and then it just kind of continued. So it wasn't Bobby's job. That was a different person's job.
But you guys hit it off right away and then you started working together.
Yeah, I think once you make it through a 23-hour day with somebody.
Yeah, it's like a war zone.
I don't know, maybe Josh just thinks he owes me for that job, but yeah, it is kind of like war. I mean, it takes you 2 or 3 days to get back to normal, so maybe Josh just felt bad for me and said, well, we'll let the kids stick around a little while, so.
Do you think that's changed a little bit of how many hours they kind of force you to put in these days, or that's pretty much still the same?
Yeah, I think it's gotten better, especially in the last, you know, 2-3 since the newest contract, especially now with 15 hours, you have to have a hotel room.
Yeah.
You can kind of use that above production's head to kind of, hey guys, like, you know, we're at 15 hours, like we're going to need hotel rooms here shortly. And,
right.
You know, doing that for 100 people, A, is safety. You know, people can just find a safe place to rest their head for the night. Cause yeah, I mean, some of the early music videos were, you know, I did one that was 3 days. First day was 22, second day was 21, and third day was 23.
That's nuts.
And that, I mean, with 10-hour turnarounds, and the thing is that in L.A., we all know, 10-hour turnaround, by the time you leave the set and get home, that takes an hour, hour and a half. And then on the way to get there, hour, hour and a half. And then to sleep and, you know, get rested and shower, you're only doing like 6-7 hours of sleep, if that. You know, per day. So when you do that many hours, it just really takes a toll. But yeah, I mean, I think I've seen a good increase in shorter hours or manageable hours in the, you know, recently. So,
which, yeah, it seems like everybody's paying a little bit more attention to the safety there.
Yeah.
And that key point.
Yeah. Cause, you know, the flip side is someone getting injured or hurt, and that's a bigger deal, you know. And
right.
I think people see the value in having well, happy, rested crews.
Right.
So, and I think too, people are just making a bigger stand. There's, you know, some gaffers I work for that just, you know, won't put up with it. And,
yeah.
And that's kind of nice. Like to just, you know, when the economy's busy and you get to kind of choose what you want to do a little bit more, you know, you don't have to take every job. You don't have to do everything that you can't put your body and mind through. That you do have a little more power in what you get, you know, what you choose to do. So
on that note, maybe there's a job or two where you had a really great time on, and maybe something sort of odd happened on that shoot. I mean, can you think of anything where something's really memorable? I mean, you've been doing this for a while, since 2001, so it's almost 20 years now.
Yeah. Man, I mean, it's great. I've been very lucky. I usually have a lot of fun on my sets. I try to keep it light, you know, especially like when I'm gaffing. We'll play games. Man, I remember back in the day, like, that first show I did in San Diego, Fashion House, like, we would play pranks on each other. We'd have a golden can of creamed corn. So every Wednesday, I would hand out a can of creamed corn to everybody, or to anybody who did was the best that day. It was like a trophy. They got to take it home, and, like, the next day, everybody would ask him how it tasted. Like, was it a good can of creamed corn? And I remember the UPM, it was I think it was her birth. It was near her birthday or something. She came on set and was asking me about the creamed corn in the truck. She's like, I saw the truck. Like, you guys got a big case of creamed corn. I said, well, yeah, you know, it's handed out on Wednesdays. And she's like, well, I've never received a can of creamed corn. So we pulled her out of her office, told her that an actress was going crazy on set and needed her and refused to come out. And then we snuck into her office and just filled it. I think, 300 cans of creamed corn.
And, I love it.
You know, she came back. She was happy. She laughed. She was a little upset, but she made all of our PAs come and cleaned it out, and we donated it all to a hunger food bank. It was right near Thanksgiving.
So. Oh, that's great, man.
Yeah, I mean, and I did some early jobs out of San Diego with some casinos, and some of the crew were just wild, and we'd get to, like, Louisiana and hire locals.
Oh, no.
They'd never been on set, and I could barely understand some of these guys. You know, just like, oh, just
yeah, that,
gro- yeah, Creole, that Creole, like, you know, and like just the weird stuff that would happen at night when you're off set. And, you know, like the local boys would be like, oh, you got to come to a cookout. And you're like, all right. And we're driving, you're getting stuck in swamps and, yep, you know, yeah, yeah. Oh, man. I, like, you look back on all the years, I've been pretty lucky at, you know, having a good time on set for sure.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, you look like a really positive, happy guy every time you come in here. Man. So, we appreciate that.
I think that keeping friendships, you know, that's one thing. There's probably a few people out there who don't think I'm such a happy, positive guy, but, you know.
Well, you probably worked on some crews where you had some really tough gaffers running the show.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Well, you don't have to mention their names, though.
Well, and even me. I remember thinking a while back, Flea has a new book, the bassist, but he says, you know, you love how you know. And so he doesn't blame, like, his dad or his, you know, people around him. He's like, no, they love me how they knew how to love, because that's right, how they had learned. And I think that's kind of true with even gaffing. Like, I've had to kind of change my style in the last 10 years. Mm. It's not, I think, particularly the good old boys club kind of a thing that it used to be, which is good. But, you know, I kind of gaffed how I had learned from previous gaffers, and a lot of them were hard asses.
Yeah.
You know, they told you what to do and you did it. Right. And I think a lot of that's disappearing.
Yep.
So even the DPs you see now, you know, James Lexton, like, you know, nicest guy, just super mellow. He works with everybody. There's no screaming and yelling, where 20 years ago, yeah, you were terrified of the DP. You did not want to be like,
that's right,
under his
yeah
thumb.
I remember this culture's definitely changed a lot in the past 20 years.
Big time.
Yeah, it was very stressful back in the day. You walk on set. I mean, I remember one time I forgot to put my phone on silent, and the fucking goes off, and I don't even want to mention the show, but I got my ass framed as a salesman from Mole Richardson. Like, it was not cool. It sticks in my head now. Every time I'm on set, I'm like, no, for sure, you're never going to forget this now, right? Once you get freaking embarrassed about it.
Yeah.
So yeah, especially in the past 20 years, see, 2001 to 2019, there's been a lot of change in the industry since then. I mean, it just started to change, I would say, around 2008 and 10, where it started to get some major changes right after the recession, and we had some strikes, and then the first LEDs are coming out, and nobody's really kind of sure about them. We don't have the correct meters really in our industry to understand the gaps that they provide or have. Tell us a little bit about how that's affected you as a gaffer, and is it a positive or negative ways of how that LED change?
Yeah, I mean, I think there was one of the biggest mistakes I ever made was I had a roommate, Dwayne Trammell, down in San Diego, who was a Navy engineer and could wire anything. Had rebuilt, you know, big ships for the Navy. And he was like, we should get into this LED business. Like, you really know lighting and you're very particular about how it's used or what and how it looks. And I told him, I said, man, it's going to be 30 years before we're using LEDs on a film set. And sure enough, like, 5 years later, you know, I owned, you know, all of my lights were LED. So, you know, I didn't see the change happening so fast. But yeah, I mean, when I first started, you know, if you knew what a Bates cable was and a Camlock cable and, you know, a distro box, you could plug in stuff and turn it on. And, you know, and now, you know, we were just talking earlier, Tim, about XY and, you know, Rec 709 color profiles matching the cameras. And you know, it's nuts how fast it's all changed. And I think most of it's a good change. You know, you're really starting to see the quality behind some of the LEDs compared to, you know, 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah.
I think companies are taking it very seriously. But I also think that the types of movies we've been making lately and the types of commercials and everything, that color temperature, and I don't want to say that CRI isn't as big of a deal, but, you know, when you're making a space movie, like, what is tungsten? What is daylight? What is, like, these certain things that...
Yeah, what does red look like on, you know, these different planets, fictional planets, right?
Right. You know, who knows? Dude, I mean, what colors are they going to make, you know? Right. And
I think Craig Frazier is one of the guys that used to say that, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, when we started, we were using HMIs. I remember when I started, we only had, like, quarter gels. So we had HMIs that were all over the place. We were using film as well, and we still make good movies. And now the tolerances are a lot smaller.
Yeah.
And at one point, it becomes sort of a little too much, maybe.
Yeah, I think there's times where it slows down things. Like, I just did a promo for a movie, and we were choosing out colors for the backgrounds. And, you know, it's on an iPad. And, like, right there, I can switch every color, everything. And you know, they're analyzing, like, can we pull out, like, this much saturation and get me to this. And you're like, yep, save that color. What are we calling that? You know, spearmint. Okay. Now give me a spearmint moss. And you're like, well, what is that? How does that look? Like, yeah, that looks great. All right, great. Save that one. You know, and I mean, we had like 7 different colors of like green, you know, spearmint just in the spearmint range. And then that doesn't include the oranges and reds and blues. And so I think, you know, it's awesome because it gives you a lot of range in like, you know, making people happy that there
otherwise
just,
it took forever cutting gel.
Oh man. And like, what were you going to do? Buy 400 rolls of gel to come out with every Lee color. It's like a wood craftsman, you know, like someone who really works with wood all the time. It's like, they have certain ideas and certain knowledge about how things will fit together, or like how to put something together. And you know, the kid who's never done it might have a rougher time figuring out something that doesn't even have to do with woodworking, just because they don't have that knowledge of, you know,
how things go together. Yeah.
And I think on the film set, like, you know, things come very fast for me now because I know what tungsten looks like. I know what daylight looks like. I've looked at hundreds of times of like in a restaurant, how's that light coming through the window, or how is this? I'm analyzing it all the time. Like, man, this would be a great like setup for, you know, how could I replicate this look of this restaurant the next time I'm in that situation, or this commercial comes up, like, man, this would be a cool way. Like, man, could we do it? You know, and analyzing even just the fall off from one window to the next window, and like how we could replicate that, maybe bouncing off of a mirror and coming back, or, you know, any of that type of stuff.
That's really interesting. I've been around quite a bit of gaffers in the past 25 years. And I noticed one of the qualities of a great gaffer is I always hear them talk. We go out to a restaurant, and we'll see like a mosaic window and light come through it. And gaffers that really care about the craft, they're always thinking about light everywhere around them and how they can duplicate it. And I think that they're just so enthralled with lighting that that's what makes them really great at replicating it at the right time.
Yeah.
So it's really interesting to point that out, because I've seen not just you, but a lot of gaffers, good ones that really care about their craft, that do that.
Yeah, I mean, that's where you get your ideas from, you know, because ultimately, too, they're not paying me for just like scientific knowledge or something that I can just reproduce, or that anybody, it's your ideas. It's how do you solve this issue, and how do you think that that looks good? We're constantly, especially in commercials, we're selling stuff. So it's constantly like, how do I figure out how to make this look cool, or how do I figure out how to make this look different from something else, or how do I make this product look the best? Because, you know, I don't keep any secrets. Any kid calls me, anybody calls me and says, hey, what did you do for this, or how did you do that? I'll tell them. Mm-hmm. I know other people don't. They keep secrets. They don't want someone to figure out, like, you know, when we used to do a lot of tabletop, you know, we'd put like CDs behind the food and spin them real slow, because we get those cool colors of like orange, red, green, blue.
Oh, cool.
And people were like, why did you share that with everybody? Or like, well, because I'm already coming up with the next idea next time. Like, if I'm always just putting CDs behind things, or we're all, you know, if we're always putting
the CD gaffer,
if we're always putting like luster, you know, or a Source 4 out of focus on the background, you know, that Dateline did it for like 25 years.
Right.
Like, what's the next thing? You know, we're laughing that, you know, in 5 or 6 years from now, people are going to be laughing at how many Astera tubes were like in the backgrounds of shots, you know, changing colors. Like, that seems to be the new like Source 4 gobo pattern breakup on the background, you know?
It's like psychedelic 60s lighting. Yeah.
Yeah. 5 years from now, I'll be like, why the heck did I put LED tubes in the background? But, you know, for now, it's like, we'll sneak by. So,
so you're mainly doing commercials, music videos these days?
Ooh, no music videos.
No music videos, just commercials, right?
Commercials, and then I do a lot of promos.
And promos.
Yeah, which, you know, you fall into the things you love. Like, you know, I bartended, and I remember complaining about drunks coming in. And another bartender said, well, it's your bar. You don't own it, but it's your bar when you're the bartender. You choose your customers. And, you know, I kind of believe that a little bit. And so the same goes for me with my company or my lights, and me is, you know, you get a choice in like who you kind of work with and who you gravitate to. And some of my clients, like, I'll go get you a coffee. I'll get you a Diet Coke. You know, you like gum on your table. Like, I'll make sure there's gum there. That's easy. You know,
especially green M&Ms.
Hey man, I'll pick them out all night. You know? So yeah. So at this point, like, mostly commercials, promos, and I do a lot of like sports hype videos, I guess. I don't know how.
Oh yeah, sure.
So like some of the local colleges and, you know, before they take the field, and, you know, those are really creative and fun. And so, you know, I still get.
So that means that your truck package has probably changed over the years, I imagine. How did, maybe give us a quick look at what it looked like in the beginning and what it's gravitating to now. And you can feel free to list gear and
Yeah. So, well, when I first started, my first lights were 3 10Ks that said Love Bug on the back. And, they had Walt Disney plaques, like,
oh, no kidding,
like riveted into them. Yeah.
Oh, and, that's great.
I bought them in Arizona for, I think, $300 each.
Wow.
And, and with bulbs, and me and a buddy, Josh Oliver, went out and got them, brought them back. And, you know, we, with Josh Oliver down in San Diego, we built up a couple trucks and had, oh man, like 2 5-tons, a 2-ton step van, you know. And in those early days, it was all about big, and we were doing TV shows, and we were renting out to local features and low budgets that would come down from LA, and done a few commercials here and there, but it was all about big. You had to have just tons of stuff and everything. And, you know, about when that recession hit, that hurt big, because San Diego really slowed down at the time. And I was kind of splitting my time between LA and San Diego. And I kind of just saw the writing on the wall a little bit for me and a little bit for where I wanted to be headed, and kind of started to downsize and just really noticed that overhead was huge for me. And, you know, you had employees and security and insurances and all this stuff, and said, you know what? Like, for me personally, I wanted to get smaller. And so now I just run with a Sprinter. From those early days of like 3 10Ks, I think we had 2 12Ks, 6Ks, 4Ks, like all sitting on a 5-ton truck just in case, to now it's, I run with like 4S60s, bunch of Lusters, still have a tungsten package, still have my Jokers, couple 400s, couple 800s, 1600, Steratubes, you know, are kind of a must right now.
Right.
Yeah, and then, you know, I fit a solid little package inside of a van, and it does about 80% of what I need. And then beyond that, we just ramp. Especially, you know, when you're looking at like these hype videos, I might have 2 S60s with me just to, like, you know, for something. But then a lot of that's going to be supplied by movers and just lights. And especially for me, I can't own those. You know, I can't own 700 lights, since we're constantly changing and what you want them to do and you know, the looks that you want to produce with them. So, you know, and that goes with like Septrons. Love those lights all the time. They have smoked out glass. You can hide them in cracks of things and you don't know they're there. And they can go up really fast and, you know, be vector programs. So you can, you know, change everything they do. They can basically be a video wall if you wanted to, you know, to Sharpies and atoms and GLPs constantly coming out with like fans that spin and move and change colors. And so, especially on some of that stuff in the promos, it's always looking for that next light. And you just, me as a small guy, can't own everything. So I think, you know, one thing too, I was telling Tim earlier is, you know, I don't hate any lights. I think even if it's just the stupidest little clip-on light that can go in your van and, you know, runs on batteries and it's supposed to be on someone's bike, there can be a use for it or a purpose to, like, use that on a film set, you know. And a great example is, like, is it Robe? In, yep. The Russian, I think they're Czech.
Yeah, Czechoslovakian, yeah. Yep.
But Robies. They make, like, eye candy lights. Mm-hmm. And I use those all the time at Fox Sports. You know, we're constantly looking for that next thing that could fit in the background. And, you know, whether it's a Rotolite or a Doppio or something that could go in the background and look kind of interesting and cool, or we could use it in a new way. So, you know, I try not to display any light that I could use for something, you know,
but right. You're still renting fixtures. You have your package, your base package, but yeah. I don't see you owning any 4K HMIs or Airy Maxes these days. Seems like a lot of gaffers have moved away from that and let the rental houses kind of handle the big guns.
Yeah. I think there's still the guys out there, you know, that have their big trucks and there's a need for it and there's a place for it. And, and I love getting with those guys and you know, doing some big stuff, but you know, I think, you kind of have to make those decisions in your life of like where you want to be and what you want to do. And for me, you know, especially after I had kids, it was like, I don't want to do the 15 hours anymore. I don't want to be on like TV, right, running cable. I still do it every once in a while, but I think I found a happy place in like promos,
and, yep,
you know, nice, simple commercials that are just, yeah, I don't get to be quite as big and creative as I used to. There's no way of figuring out like how to rig this 40 by 40 over the downtown city street. But at the same time, like, I can concentrate on kind of the smaller things and make sure that looks really good. So at least I can find joy in what I'm doing. So
that's some really good advice, finding joy in what you're doing and trying to carve out what's fun for you. So getting into that a little bit, I think there'll be some really young gaffers out there that'd be interested in hearing any kind of advice you might have in sort of working with not only just DPs, but the line producers or everyone on set. Is there some challenges there with budgets and how do you get around all that?
Man, yeah, that's the not fun stuff. Segue from fun to not fun. Yeah, that's like the hardest thing. And that was for me, at least when I first started, you know, I had my buddy, Josh Oliver, who, you know, really helped me a lot on the business side. He kind of handled that stuff, and I could just kind of be the artist. And, you know, and as I got older and older, I just had to kind of learn. And I think don't be afraid. The producer's a person too. I tend to find that the more friendly I am with people, the more hard it is for them to get mad at me.
Right.
So if you go into a situation kind of puffing your chest, you know, even if it's just over like $300 budget, that instantly they're going to want to puff up their chest. And you'll see that all the time on sets of, you know, someone says something to try to show that they've got power, and, you know, someone else pushes back. And I think that's still a little bit of the old Hollywood, you know, the
little residue.
Sure, I know I have the power, you know, and then I don't want to say that never happens or it shouldn't happen. You know, it all has its place. But yeah, I think if you go into those situations with UBMs and just be honest, and with DPs, there's times where I have to say no, like, you know, we just can't do that. It's unsafe, or it's producers giving us our budget. There's not a way, but let's figure out that problem. I think that's one of the big things about film sets is you're getting paid for your ideas and your problem solving. Mm. And the better you do those things, the more you're going to make, you know, and the more people will want to work with you. You know, right. The worst thing to tell a DP or, you know, is we can't do that. No, figure out how, you know, like figure out what it is that can do that look without having to do that. I mean, we're, you know, it happens every day, 10 times a day on a lighting set. You know, that's why you see some of the best always making great movies and great commercials and everything else, because they're able to never get stuck in that situation. They can figure out that way to make it work without sacrificing quality. I think that's the other thing, is like trying not to sacrifice your quality. Yeah.
Yeah.
Something
I mean,
like that.
Kind of reminds me, Eric Messerschmidt, he said one time that he feels like he's sort of a cinematographer's caddy. And I could see where, you know, cinematographer wants to get on the green in one, but they're like, hey, dude, you have to lay up, okay? There's trees, there's a lake. Why don't you use this light instead? And then we'll get you a clear shot to the green from there. But
yeah, Terrence, a good friend of mine, Terrence Hayes, amazing cinematographer. He goes back to some of his colleges and talks to some of the young students, and he always asks them, what's a cinematographer's job? And he's like, well, it's in charge of the lighting. No. I mean, you're in charge of camera? No. Camera and lighting? No. It's like, all right, guys, I'm the best friend to the director. You know, I'm the counselor to the lead actress. Actually, most of my time isn't spent lighting. It's spent, you know, being best friends with someone, or, you know, giving someone a hug. And, you know, he's not terribly wrong all the time. So
yeah, it's something Tim and I talk about a lot. It's actually interesting when we watch movie credits, gaffers and electricians are like way down the list. It's like one of the biggest budget departments and do the most work and have most impact on the film and the look. And they're sort of like the unsung heroes. I mean, you'll see a sound mixer, you know, get his credits run before the gaffer, right? Yeah,
it's hard to find those credits on IMDb. They get buried too.
Yeah, I wonder if that's just an old history stigma, like even just the names. Gaffer, which originally in England meant like jokester, and best boy.
I thought it was the gaff pole that they used to light street lamps.
Yeah, maybe
that's
it.
That's what I heard.
But yeah, I mean, I know in England, it's if you even type up gaffer like on Instagram, you'll find like jokesters, like pranksters is what a gaffer is in England.
Yeah, all that cream corn.
I got to bring that back. That was one of my better ones. But I think even that's changing in the industry. In a lot of ways, it's gotten more professional. I don't really put gaffer on my time cards anymore. It's CLT, Chief Lighting Technician, or Assistant Chief Lighting Technician, or Set Light Technician. So I think you'll see those things changing. Also, just the knowledge you need to know. Like back in the day, like I said, if you could plug in a Bates and a cam lock, you know what a distro box was, you couldn't mess anything up. It was. They're all different shapes.
Yeah.
You could do that and like kind of work on a film set. Now, I mean, we're setting IP addresses, and I spent 4 hours yesterday setting up IP addresses with a buddy's wireless system. And it's like, I never thought I'd ever need to be able to figure these things out, but you know, that's just kind of where the industry is going. And for good reason too, we're not knuckle draggers anymore. We're pretty smart, skilled technicians. And
lighting has gotten so sophisticated. There's so many options with color and wireless and DMX control, and it doesn't seem to be slowing down. And the guys that rise to the top are embracing the technology like yourself and working really hard to understand it and how to apply it on these sets these days.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, probably these nomenclatures for the things that you guys do, which are incredible and I admire personally, needs to maybe change. Like, maybe you guys need to be called lighting directors or something like that, something a little bit more fitting for, you know, what you guys do on set, wow. The magic you guys create.
Wow, that's... Supreme leader could that rolls off the tongue too, you know. So,
yeah, I like that one.
Pardon powers would be nice. I, you know, got a few buddies who are in trouble. I could clear up their records, maybe. But yeah, I think there is respect though. Like, you know, for the things we go through on set, there's a reason we're wrapping 2 hours after everybody else. Like, there's a lot of cable, and you know, it's hard work, but you know, it's also. You have to be smart. You can't really just skip by anymore.
Yep.
You know, and use all the new technology. I mean, running FireWire cable, I never would have thought 10 years ago I'd be dealing with, you know, Ethernet and Cat5 and, you know, some of the wireless, like how fast wireless has taken over, you know, of this job. I'd say 60-70% of the lights are built in now, you know, of the stuff we're using. And you're just getting those to link sometimes in different systems. And as companies kind of fight over things, well, will this system talk to this system and, like, you know, and being controlled. And your department's on set, you know, a dimmer board used to be like a dimmer board, maybe an assistant. And now there's DMX specialists.
Yeah.
And you might have two or three. And, you know, and you get on some of those big shows, like some of my buddies on Mandalorian, dimmer board department's 5-6 guys.
Incredible.
You know, all the tech and, you know, make sure the set doesn't get shut down. So, you know, that things are working. And yeah, those guys definitely earn respect, man.
Yeah, for sure.
If not just from the rest of the film community, from other electricians.
That's right.
Because, man, that stuff, that's tough to be a specialist in, you know? So. Yeah.
Well, Chris, I really appreciate you coming in, Mackem, and sharing your thoughts with us today. Very useful for a lot of guys, especially the younger crew coming up in the ranks. Any one last words, anything you might be looking forward to lighting-wise this year? You heard any new lights that are coming out that should might change us?
I mean, me and Tim have talked about a few here and there, but, you know, a nice 650 full color, you know, built in. Oh, that would be, I'd love that with a nice little white point. I've heard some rumors of...
There's a couple good ones coming out.
Yeah, that's what I've heard. So I can't wait to get my hands on them. There's some big companies that are jumping into, like, more film-style lighting.
Right.
Worrying about some CRIs, and that's kind of interesting. And it's also nice that some of these companies have really reached out to lighting community and camera community to, like, see what we need. And that's really nice, you know, for years of kind of rode coattails on, you know, Craig Keefe shot, like, Muppet stuff that I used to juice in the early days. And I know he's working with ETC on those lights. So at least it's getting some good feedback on what we need. Nothing worse than just making a light because an engineer thinks it's a light that's needed.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, Tom at Cream Source has done a lot of work in the past year interviewing his customers and figuring out what they wanted. And now he's got some fixtures coming out in a few weeks. I don't think we can talk about them yet, but really cool feedback. And he's quickly created those fixtures. We're talking like 17-degree RGBAW fixtures that are completely weatherproof. Really inexpensive. So a lot of exciting stuff coming out this year in the way of RGBAW. I think we're going to see a lot more hard light coming out this year. Instead of these soft panels, we're gonna I think, see a lot of these companies do a little bit more optics. Anyway, thanks a lot, Chris. We love having you, man. We're going to have you come back again someday.
Let's do it.
This is the Lamb Doc. I'm your host, Mike McDonald, sitting here with my producer, Timmy One Take. Thanks for joining us. See you on the next episode.